Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Now here's a highlight from Coast to Coast AM on iHeartRadio.
Cold War started in 1947, ended in 1991. What happened? Why'd you pick this? And let's get into this, because this is a very historical moment on this planet.
Yeah, this is a big, big story. So many books are written each year about the Second World War, and yet so few books look at those years immediately after the post-war, after the war had ended, when really the entire world is up for grabs. You know, there's got to be a new world order has got to be sorted out. And really, this begins at the famous Yalta Conference in 1945, when the three big beasts get together. That is President Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, and Stalin. They meet and they try and thrash out what the world is going to look like in the post-war period. And it's really planning. This sets in motion everything that is going to happen for the next, 20, 30 years.
General Patton warned us after World War II to be careful of the Soviet Union. What did he see that so many people missed at that time, Giles?
Well, you need to realize that before the Second World War, Stalin had really been seen as the enemy of the United States and the enemy of Great Britain, of the West in general.
Right.
But then Hitler invades the Soviet Union, and suddenly he becomes an ally. And the Allies, the Americans and British, find themselves fighting on the same side as Stalin. The great question after the war was, would this wartime alliance hold together? Was it possible to keep Stalin on board in the post-war period? And, President Roosevelt and Churchill, initially, they very much hoped that this would happen. They wanted to keep Stalin on board. But it gradually became apparent that this was not going to be the case, that Stalin had reverted to being the enemy of the West.
And, of course, Stalin was a butcher, killed millions of his own people. He was hated by a lot, but feared by many.
That's right. I mean, he'd killed absolutely millions of his own citizens. He'd had the great show trials in which he'd killed his own people, his own politicians, And by 1945, by the time the war is coming to an end, the Red Army has swept through most of Eastern Europe and parts of Central Europe, and really is in control of much of the territory that Stalin wants to hold on to after the war. And the Americans and Brits, of course, are still a long way to the west. They've only just crossed the border into Germany. So Stalin has pretty much got what he wants by the time the war is coming to an end.
After World War I, did we not chop up Germany, or did we keep it the whole?
Well, Germany had been, the frontiers had changed a little bit. Territories had been moved around. But essentially, and this is what Hitler exploited, building this greater Germany in which Germany was, its frontiers were going to be rolled backwards and backwards until the country got bigger and bigger and more powerful. Of course, in 1939, you have this bizarre pact between the two monsters of the world, if you like, when Hitler and Stalin enter into an alliance, the famous Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, in which suddenly these two hideous powers are on the same side. But this is not going to last, because what happens in 1941, Hitler takes a gamble and invades the Soviet Union. And this is the point where Stalin, he's no longer in an alliance with Hitler, he's forced into the arms of Roosevelt and Churchill. So you have this most unlikely alliance of the monster in Moscow allied with the American president and the British prime minister.
And that could have been Hitler's biggest blunder in the war. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, lots of people have argued that Hitler lost the war the minute he invaded the Soviet Union, because he just didn't realize what a big, nut he was trying to crack there.
And why did he do that, Giles?
Because he wanted to expand his territories. He had an eye on all the rich oil fields of the Caucasus. And all the raw materials, the valuable raw materials of the Soviet Union. And he thought it would be very easy to crush the Red Army. What he didn't bank on, as had been the problem with Napoleon all those years before, is the ferocity of the Soviet winter. And it was this that was really going to do for the Wehrmacht, for the German army, that they didn't get the swift victory they were hoping for. They ended up just outside the gates of Moscow, just outside the gates of Leningrad, and then the snow started to fall and the troops started to freeze. And so this was the big turning point for Hitler, the point at which one could say, although the war was going to last another few years, you could say at this point Hitler had actually lost the war.
I don't want to dwell on World War II, because the Cold War is a very important subject tonight, but I do have to ask you, why did Hitler, and how was he able to pull the wool over so many people before the war? He had bankers in the United States, politicians. He had a lot of people supporting him. How did he pull that off?
It's very difficult to answer that, but you're absolutely right. I mean, American money was pouring into Germany at this time. I think he exploited the fact that after the First World War, the Germans, having, of course, started the war and led to the deaths of millions of people, they felt hard done by it in the eventual peace that happened in 1918. And Hitler exploited that. He was forever banging on about, building this greater Germany, and people bought into that narrative. And although one should remember there were many Germans who did not support Hitler, there were enough for him to get himself into the position of absolute power. And from that point on, there was no looking back.
And they say the Holocaust started around 1941. Might it have started much earlier and nobody knew about it?
Well, it depends on how you actually define the Holocaust. Of course, the horrific mass killing started at that time. But you've already got violent anti-Semitism taking place in Germany before that. You've got the infamous Kristallnacht, when all the Jewish shops in Germany were smashed to pieces and set on fire. This was some years before. So I think the warning signals were already there. The bells were ringing, but people just didn't want to hear them.
So the war ends. Who decides to divide up Berlin?
So this is what happens at the Yalta Conference. This is where the big three meet in the city of Yalta in the Crimea, and they are there to thrash out this new world order. What they decide, and specific to Germany, is that Germany is going to be divided into, effectively split down the middle. And the Soviet Union, Stalin's Soviet Union, is going to control the east part of Germany, and British and Americans are going to control the west part of Germany. So that's how they split up the country. But then there's the prize of Berlin, the former German capital. What happens with that? Well, they decide they're going to do exactly the same thing. The Soviets are going to get the east of the city, and the Brits and Americans are going to get the west of the city. Now, this all seems sort of fair and equitable and what have you. But there is one potential massive problem, and that is this. Berlin lies fairly and squarely in what is going to be the Soviet occupied sector of occupied Germany.
Right. It's right. It's right on the east side.
It's going to be, it's like a little island. If you can imagine a little island in a sea of red. So the American garrison and the British garrison are going to be entirely surrounded by Russian-controlled territory filled with Red Army soldiers. Now, if they keep on good terms with the with Stalin and the Soviet Union, this won't be a problem. But what happens if things go wrong? Suddenly, you have these garrison forces, you have the American sector and the British sector completely isolated from the rest of Germany and in potential, in real danger from the Red Army should things turn sour.
Who decides to put up the wall?
Well, the wall is going to come much, much later. This is not till the early 60s.
Uh-huh.
But what is happening in the immediate aftermath of the war, as the Soviets take over their sector of the city and the American and Brits take over their sector, and as the wartime alliance begins to fall apart, it's realized that there is a real danger zone in Berlin, because you have the West and East staring at each other with guns and tanks in the streets. So it's a very, very tense situation already in 1945.
I was always puzzled by that, because they did divide Germany West and East. The United States and groups took over the West part. The Soviet Union took over the East. And as you point out, Berlin is right in the middle of the Soviet side. So how did we get to, whenever we wanted to get to the western part of Berlin that we controlled, which is weird, we control that city within the Soviets' control of the whole eastern section of Germany. How did we get through? Like they had, like you mentioned, guns and soldiers. Yeah, we had to get through.
Very good question. So, if your listeners can imagine, you're sitting on this island surrounded by this sea of red, and the western sectors are on this island. The only way into the city was by one autobahn, one motorway, one rail link. These were the only links from western occupied Germany, the western sectors of occupied Germany, into Berlin, into the western sectors of Berlin. Now, as long as that railway line kept open, as long as that motorway kept open, it was all well and good. But what is going to happen, what happens if Stalin decides to block those routes into Berlin? Suddenly, it's like a medieval castle. The Western garrisons, the soldiers from America and British, are going to find themselves cut off, isolated, without food, without supplies, without anything. And this is going to become an incredibly dangerous situation.
And they say about 81,000 Soviet soldiers died taking Berlin, 92,000 Germans died, and we backed out. We basically let the Soviets go in and take Berlin, didn't we?
Yeah, and I think this is a really, really important point to remember, actually, is that the Red Army got to Berlin long before the American and British forces. And so, in fact, several months before. And this gave them several months when they were in the city by themselves, without the Western allies there. And this gave them the ability, basically, to loot, to ransack, and to rape, untrammeled, unhindered by anyone else. And this is exactly what happened. The Red Army, by this point, was a drunken rabble that came into the city intent on getting their revenge. It should be pointed out, of course, the German army had ransacked its way through the Soviet Union. They wanted their revenge, and they took it, in those 2 months before the Western allies arrived. My goodness, they ransacked the city. They looted it. Berlin was one of the great cultural capitals of the world. It had these museums stuffed full of the great treasures of Western civilization. All of these were packed up and carted off to Moscow. All the most famous scientists and engineers were arrested and kidnapped and taken off to Moscow. And unfortunately and tragically, many, many of the women in Berlin were raped by these drunken and unruly Red Army soldiers.
And apparently 27 million Soviets have died during World War II from all causes, soldiers and civilians. 27 million people.
I know, and I think often in certainly in my own country, in Britain, and I think in America too, it's often the sacrifice of the Soviet Union, of Russia in the Second World War, is often overlooked. We tend to think of the Western Front, we think of D-Day and the great heroism, justified heroism of the Americans and British and Canadians, you know, in Normandy and fighting their way into Germany. But as you say, millions and millions of Russian soldiers, you know, young conscripts, teenagers like the Americans and Brits at D-Day, lost their lives fighting this terrible Nazi war machine.
Your book, Giles, has some personality to it because you talk about a couple characters. One is Colonel Frank Howland Mad Howley, who was the United States' representative in Berlin, and then the Soviets had Alexander Kotikov.
Yes, so the city has been divided up. So you've got the Soviets in the eastern sector of the city, and their sector of the city is to be run by, as you say, General Alexander Kotikov. In the west part of the city, you've got the American and British sectors, and the French will come in slightly later. And the American sector is to be run by this absolutely fabulous character called, as you say, Colonel Frank Howling Mad Howley. He's to be the commandant of the American sector, and he is to run it with a rod of iron. He went into Berlin thinking that the Germans were the enemy. After all, this is who he's been fighting, you know, against for the last couple of years. But as soon as he gets to Berlin, he realizes, actually, the Germans are no longer the enemy. It's really the Russians who are our enemy. It's the Russians who want to take over the whole of Berlin, the whole of Germany, and if they can, the whole of Western Europe. So from a very early, moment, Frank Howley identifies Stalin and the Russians as the enemy, and he will do absolutely everything to sort of declare his own personal war against Alexander Kotikov and the Russians.
What kept the Soviets from trying to throw us out?
I think, well, there had been this agreement at Yalta that had been decided that this is how it was going to be run. And I think in the early days, everyone was sort of feeling their way towards the future, really. And no one wanted to rock the boat too much. So I think they were genuinely wanted to try and have a go at keeping the peace together and remaining as allies. But it quickly became apparent that what Stalin wanted was domination of Eastern and Central Europe, and also he already had his eyes on Germany. He wanted to take control of Germany, but to do that, he knew he'd have to force a showdown with the Americans and Brits, and this was a very tense moment to do that.
I remember Cold War episodes in school, Giles, where we had bomb training exercises, where we had to sit down with our heads in between our legs under a desk in the event there was an atomic bomb. I mean, they scared the living daylights out of us when we were just kids.
I know. I remember, you know, growing in the 70s, I remember the government in Britain issued a leaflet on how to build your nuclear bomb shelter.
Yes.
I mean, it's quite extraordinary. And then, of course, many listeners will remember, you know, Ronald Reagan's famous speech. Well, first of all, Kennedy's famous speech in Berlin, and then, you know, Reagan's speech, you know, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. All these moments, I mean, from my childhood and when I was a teenager, everything was really set in motion in these first years after the First World War, after the Second World War. This is when all the tensions that are going to come out over the next decades are set in motion in this period.
Can you blame or can you thank Gorbachev for bringing that wall down?
I think he had decided that the situation, the Cold War situation, was no longer tenable. And I mean, it's a fascinating period, the Gorbachev, Thatcher, and Reagan period, where the Cold War is really beginning to, it's coming to an end. And, you know, you've got the Soviet Union in a state of complete collapse as well. Here's this massive nuclear power with almost nuclear parity with the United States, and yet it's a country that can scarcely feed itself. I think it was untenable for the Soviet Union to continue, and Gorbachev recognized that. And I think he recognized in both Reagan and Thatcher people with whom he could do business.
Listen to more Coast to Coast AM every weeknight at 1 a.m. Eastern, and go to coasttocoastam.com for more.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.